the Weekly Poll Sunday. I am your host, Jeff Snyder, and being joined, of course, by one of our great contributors, George Grombacher. George, how are you, bud?
I am doing fantastic, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining you today from Red Wing, Minnesota, at a friend's wedding. So
that's awesome. And you are a Minnesota native, is that correct?
It is my home state as well. When I arrived and got off the plane, there were no signs, which was to be expected, but still a little bit disappointing.
Well, we have a sign here. We have a hot sign here for you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're glad to talk to you, and I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C. I was at the Spark National Conference, and I'm very sad to report that Natalie is on vacation. She's in Switzerland this week.
Good for her.
So good for her, bad for us. So she'll be joining us, I think, next week. Look forward to having her back. But a lot is going on this week, and before we get started, I did want to wish you and all the dads out there a very happy Father's Day. You know, we record on Friday, but we air on Sunday, and that's Father's Day. And, you know, I'm really appreciative of my father and my stepfather, and I know you're a great dad. And for all the dads out there, happy Father's Day.
Yeah, I echo that, and thank you so much, and happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. It's a very important job.
It is a really important job, and so is what we're doing, I think. It's not really a job. It's a passion for all of us on the show, and this is for educational purposes. Just want to remind the audience there's no advice or guidance on the show. We're just people contributing, sharing their knowledge, and you can take what you want from it. Hopefully there's some good nuggets of information along the way. We enjoy each other's company, and we hope that you obviously enjoy the back and forth, the repartee that we always have with each other. And I think that's one of the great things about what we're doing. George, really interesting story I saw today, and I actually posted it on the Morning Pulse and on LinkedIn. It's the top worries by country. And I guess there was a survey done by Ipsos, which I guess is a consulting or a survey firm. They surveyed over 250,000 adults between the ages of 16 and 64 from January to December 2017. And they ranked the responses and what those people around the globe were most worried about. And what I took away, you know, the top five were unemployment, corruption, financial, political scandals, poverty, social inequity, crime and violence, and number five was healthcare. And, you know, we talk on the show about retirement, but healthcare is a big part of retirement. How are people going to pay for their healthcare today and in the future? And, you know, I think it's obviously disconcerting to see all, you know, the people are aggrieved around the world that they have concerns. But looks like healthcare continues its climb on the survey. So, you know, I think we got to do more talking about this and kind of helping to assuage any concerns people have.
Well, that is a comprehensive survey for sure, 250,000 people. And you posted that, and I read it, and I thought, well, what is really most important about that? And I think what I sort of settled on was whatever people are ruminating on and concerned about, if it is healthcare or if it's unemployment, I think it's super important to talk about those things, but what I'm hopeful of is that it motivates those people who are sharing those responses to take action, and if it's worried about unemployment, get out there and learn a new skill or make yourself more marketable, or if it's you're worried about healthcare, dig into that a little bit, start putting away a little bit extra money. So I guess fundamentally I hope that inspires people to take action.
So. Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a great show this week. We're going to be talking to quite a few people. From Angela Etinelli is back from the Georgetown University Center for Retirement Initiatives. We've got Kara Goetz from the U.S. House of Representatives. Josh Franzell is back with his colleague Gerald Young from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. And then we're going to wrap things up with Lori Rawley from the National Association of Retirement Plan Participants. I don't know how I did that all from the top of my head. But of course, we've got our great set of contributors who we'll bring on from during the show. So I say we just get started, and let's see if we can bring on Ms. Antonelli.
Excellent.
So let's just pick up, and we'll try calling.
Call Kara.
Kara. And I'm going to send Angela a note, okay. And then we'll just pick it up after. And I'll just make some kind of like statement like, you know, technical difficulties. What are you going to do?
I wouldn't even worry about it.
Okay.
Don't even worry about it, man. 202-236-4163. Don't even worry about it.
Okay.
Right on to Kara. It's dialing.
All right.
Hey, Kara.
Hello.
Hi, Kara. How are you?
How are you?
It's Jeff and George.
How are you?
Doing well. It's Jeff Snyder, George Grombacher from the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Good. So, any questions before we get started?
Nope.
Okay. So, George, why don't you count us down, and then I'll introduce Kara, and we'll just have a nice, friendly conversation and for about 10 minutes, Kara.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Okay.
Awesome.
You're quite welcome.
3, 2, 1.
So we're going to kick things off. Last week we had Beth Bell from the United States Senate, and we're very privileged to be joining someone from the U.S. House of Representatives. She's the Chief Tax Counsel, Ms. Kara Goetz. Kara, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very privileged to have you on the show, and we know that you're extremely busy, but we wanted to kind of get your take on what's going on in the House of Representatives and in Congress in terms of retirement and tax legislation. But before you say a word, I want to give the a little bit of a disclaimer that you are here representing your own opinions and not necessarily the opinions of any particular congressperson or the House. These opinions are yours and yours only. So now that that's out of the way, what's happening in the U.S. House of Representatives? Not much, right?
What's going
on?
Not much, right? Yeah, I mean, we obviously did have a very busy end of the year last year in terms of tax, so it has certainly been quieter than it was at the end of last year. But there's some things that are percolating, and so I'll start a little bit on tax, and then I'll kind of switch to retirement. But as I'm sure folks have seen in terms of the press reports, the Republicans are working on a tax reform 2.0. Mr. Brady said earlier this week that he expects to have an outline released before the August recess, so in just a few weeks. We've been hearing this rumor for quite some time, and I know at one point we were hearing that they were shooting for tax day back in April. So I think things are still probably very fluid, but we're expecting that this is something that might come up in September before the elections. The Democrats are not a part of this process. Our understanding, though, is what they're looking at is making the individual provisions permanent in H.R. 1, potentially looking at expensing, we've heard, making those provisions permanent. I think there's kind of some debate within their caucus as to whether some or all of this should be paid for. We've also heard that retirement's under consideration, maybe looking at capital gains, education tax provisions, things along those lines. So we have heard that it sounds like they're meeting kind of regularly, the Republicans on this. But again, the Democrats aren't part of necessarily part of this process. We do, on the HR1 front, one thing that we have been very active on as Democrats as well is I'd say most of our meetings that we do as tax counsels for Ways and Means members, and I'm sure my Senate Finance Committee folks are doing the same thing, are individuals and businesses coming in with technical corrections and substantive fixes to H.R. 1. Obviously, it was a pretty rushed procedure in terms of getting it through. My boss keeps mentioning the number 51 days, and so anytime you do, whether it's in 51 days or 3 years, anytime we do major legislation, usually there are some glitches that we have to fix here and there. So we do a tremendous amount of meetings on that particular topic, I think, looking towards the future. And when it's just not clear, it's a strange year this year because it's an election year. And so it's just hard really to get anything done in an election year. So there's just not a lot of time to get things done. And then just I would close in terms of what we're working on the retirement front. I happen to work for the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, Richie Neal from Massachusetts, who's very passionate about retirement issues. And so whether Mr. Neal continues to be the ranking member or the House flips and he becomes the chairman, retirement will be one of our key focuses. It's certainly one of his key focuses. And in that regard, he's put together a number of bills that he's introduced that he's hopeful will get to act on at some point. He has kind of a broader bill that we call the Auto 401k bill that will require employers that don't currently offer a retirement plan to offer a savings opportunity through a 401k plan to their employees. We have a tax credit to cover any administrative expenses that may incur. We, the very small businesses and businesses that have been in business for less than 3 years would be excluded. But it's kind of a continuation of an issue that he's been working on for quite some time. And then he has other legislation that in some ways I call RISA 2.0. For those of you who are familiar with, the Senate Finance Committee passed the Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act back in 2016 that included some smaller but very important fixes to our retirement system, things like addressing open multiple employer plans, the one bad apple rule, addressing that, and the commonality issue on the labor side. So Mr. Neal is working on legislation that's kind of taking, and actually Mr. Neal has a number of provisions in RISA, but kind of let's do the next round of these RISA-type provisions. And so he's working on that, and that includes things like portability in terms of lifetime income. If you work for an employer who offers some sort of lifetime income product, and they're with, let's say, ABC company, but then your employer switches to XYZ, who does not offer your lifetime income product, you could roll it over to an IRA. So common sense things like that. That actually provision is also in RISA. So we're just kind of getting prepped. I know if the House does flip, Mr. Neal has said that one of his big priorities would be retirement.
Oh, that's music to our ears, because that's obviously our key issue. But retirement is so important on a number of fronts for people. And if people want to track these bills, they can certainly go out to, I think there's all different sites, but one that I use is GovTrackUS is out there. You can put the different bills in to kind of see where they are in terms of passage. Kara, when you're how much do you work? I mean, obviously, you know, we talk to Beth, we talk to you. How much do you all work together when you're drafting bills? So when Representative Neal comes up with an idea, a concept, does it typically vet that through the Ways and Means, or is there some work that's done at some point between the Senate Finance or whoever has the jurisdiction over that particular bill to make sure that things go smoother than, you know, just passing a bill and then the Senate's got to pass a bill and kind of come, you know, conference committee? I mean, you guys talk to each other, I'm assuming?
Yeah, definitely. And many of us, like I just, When RISA was passed by the Senate Finance Committee, I was the pension counsel over there. So we have long existing relationships with folks. And so certainly when we introduce these bills, we make sure that everyone's in the loop and a bipartisan basis. I mean, one of the great things about the RISA that passed in 2016 and the bill that Mr. Neal is working on now, the RISA 2.0, is that all of these provisions are bipartisan provisions. So we certainly want to make sure that our Republican colleagues are in the loop as well. But another key entity that we always reach out to is the Joint Committee on Taxation and make sure that from a technical perspective, these things make sense. And so we work very closely with them as well.
That's
excellent. Kara, I'm curious, what's being talked about in regards to capital gains?
Yeah, and we're obviously not in the room, but what we hear is that they're looking at potentially indexing, some sort of indexing in terms of capital gains. There has been some talk about that maybe Treasury has some authority to do that on their own today, but I've heard kind of mixed. I think even some folks on the Hill have weighed in saying that that is not the case. So I think in some ways the Republicans may be looking at kind of holes in their bill. There's only so much. I mean, they did a lot in
sure.
HR1 to their credit. And I know, though, when Chairman Brady would talk to, for example, even the Ways and Means Democrats, I remember when he met with them at one point, he did mention an interest in doing something on capital gains, and that was something that they weren't able to do. But it's hard to say. I mean, we just get all of this from news reports and kind of gossip. And fortunately, we're friendly with a number of Republicans, and so just that through word of mouth. So it's not clear, but it sounds like at least that's something they're thinking of.
Got it. Excellent. Well, I know that Jeff and I certainly are so appreciative of your time and all of your work. So thank you so much for coming on.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
Welcome back, everybody. Joining us now, Mr. Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg, Mr. Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Trust that your trip to Singapore was successful, and I want to know what Dennis Rodman is really like in person. But before we talk about that, I know, Oliver, you are headed to the NASDAQ to do a live show or a show at with TD Ameritrade. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah, we go every like about second Monday. We're at the NASDAQ doing live shows from the market site. So the network's going to be doing a great program there. We got a bunch of CEOs lined up. CEO, we're talking REITs with the CEO of Brixmore. We're going to biotech and hematology, talking with the CEO of TG Therapeutics, and then a new company there on the shipping side that's listing. So a lot of big topics to talk about. Some great guests on the market side as well. And we're also going to talk a little bit of weed, guys. We're going to talk about the cannabis investment space post-Canada. So it's going to be fun.
Excellent. Kevin, how has the market been from your perspective this week, sir?
Well, it's been pretty pretty benign on the surface. I can't comment too much on the weed stocks. I haven't looked at them a couple of days. No, overall,
all right.
It's been calm on the surface, even though you kind of had that 1-2 punch this week in terms of global central banks. You had the Fed on Wednesday, ECB yesterday. Fed, I mean, we expected a rate rise, so that was kind of priced in. You got a bit of a more hawkish tone out of the Fed in terms of, you know, kind of trying to stay on that path. It'll be interesting, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, in terms of, you know, how that plays out the rest of the year, whether they do actually, you know, I think this year isn't nearly as interesting as what happens over the next, you know, 12 months to 18 months. 2019 is going to be very interesting in terms of what they end up doing. The ECB made some headlines this week, and we can kind of get into, I know Oliver has some opinions on this too, but, you know, we really think the ECB is the central bank to be watching right now. I mean, they came out and talked about how they're going to be ending their QE, their asset purchase program, you know, by the end of this year. But, you know, Mario Draghi also commented on leaving interest rates, you know, record lows through at least the summer of next year, which obviously gives him a lot of leeway if the data does not agree with hiking rates then. So we think a lot of, you know, overall in the equity market specifically too, a lot of that monetary policy for the next, you know, 6 months or so is probably more baked in than what happens, you know, across the pond in Europe. So ECB is definitely what we're watching from a policy standpoint.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think that definitely the story of the week for sure, ECB. I think that it was a really great opportunity for markets to get some transparency on really what's important to investors and where the uncertainty or potential for risk lies. And to Kevin's point, I think it very much is with the ECB. You had a hawkish Fed and all the market action that happened on that Wednesday, which was somewhat higher yields, were essentially undone the next day. And then kind of the cherry on top, of course, was Bank of Japan even getting a little bit more dovish on their inflation outlook. So this is the market action that happened as a result, which on the week is going to be growth names. They're really the only factor sizably up. Technology, yeah, they're probably going to end about 50 bips up. But really, it's consumer discretionary that's taken off the growth factor. Utilities as well getting a bid as real estate companies actually catch up to financials. So you basically had what is turning out to be a shockingly similar economic backdrop of this year to 2017 than many people expected, I think. This is why since really March, we've been talking about the dollar so much on the network, because this week's action is just really a great sort of microcosm of what really I think has been the backdrop for these growth companies continuing to come back after every sell-off. I mean, there was this catch-all buzz phrase of synchronized global growth that basically started us off on the year. Then everything outside the U.S. economy kind of slowed. You had a political strife at the Eurozone, so ECB can't really do much right now. As Kevin just pointed out, it's going to be at least a year. So that basically keeps the bond sell-off for U.S. markets in check. And, you know, why not then have an environment that looks like 2017? And I think that just basically continued this week.
Nice.
You guys, we just had Kara Goetz on from the U.S. House. She works for Representative Real, and Representative Neal, and we just talked about tax cuts 2.0. Wondering if that's getting factored in. We're hearing some rumblings about some revisions to the tax cuts that just occurred in 2017 for 2018. Maybe some ways, some cleanup that gets worked on. We're not sure whether or not it's really going to happen because of the, due to the midterms. But is any of that getting baked into the market? Is that in your talks with analysts, CEOs, et cetera? Are you hearing any grumblings about this?
We did a little bit of work on it actually this week, kind of more so looking at the potential for cap gains and dividend taxes and things like that. Won't reiterate, I'm sure, what your prior guests have talked about in terms of the real estate market, specifically REITs when you look at, you know, equities. That's probably the sector that potentially could get affected most. But when you look at just kind of broader markets, it's not going to be a huge difference or a huge change. And a lot of that cap gains, you know, if you, let's say, for example, if you had, you know, a little bit of relief from the cap gains tax, a lot of that does really accumulate to kind of this top, you know, 1% or whatever, 0.1%, whichever demographic you want to argue. So, you know, it's not really something we've looked into just to see if there was something there. But historically, we went back over the last few, you know, probably 50 years or so and looked at last regimes. And there really wasn't a ton there in terms of, you know, what happened for markets.
Got it. Hey, Oliver or Kevin.
Yeah.
If I'm investing, or rather, I am investing in my company's 401k. Am I investing in cannabis companies right now, or like honestly?
Probably not unless the risk manager has gone AWOL. There are more and more companies. I mean, like Canopy Growth is a good example. CGC just got a more sort of official listing. So their stock has done pretty solidly. I don't know if we talked about this last time with sort of different FOMO trades around the world, but the start of 2018 basically saw a Bitcoin-ish movement in these cannabis stocks where they just soared and then crashed, and some of them don't really exist anymore and others are doing pretty well. Canopy Growth has got a big vote of confidence from Constellation Brands, the distributor of Corona and Modelo, and I think you'll probably start to see more of that. Seems like only a matter of time before tobacco companies and start to explore it more deeply. That's pretty much what we're going to explore on Monday. Hopefully I'll have some more answers for you then.
Yeah, I'd say your exposure is limited. The only real exposure you get, to Oliver's point, is if you have some of these more these larger companies that are part of, you know, certain indices, whether it's S&P 500 or other funds that you're invested in if you're in a 401k, that actually take a, you know, financial stake or an economic stake in some of these companies. But I mean, right now it's very small.
People can always consult their prospectus, right? They can look online, look at their ticker symbol, and certainly see whether or not there is exposure. Just real quick question as it relates to cannabis: are any of these stocks, do they have the ticker THC? I'm just curious.
Yes.
If that's the ticker symbol.
That's the question.
That's currently taken by Tenet Healthcare, Mr. Snyder, but a good question.
You know, I figured I wouldn't out myself as being inquisitive about that. Not necessarily interested in using the product, but
no, of course not.
Always interested in I don't even know how we're going to get this past compliance, but that's a whole other story.
I think it's time to talk about something important. Dennis Rodman looked pretty good. Could he, Kevin, still rip down 10 boards a game in today's NBA?
In today's NBA, in his current condition,
yep.
It's tough to bet against him. 10 boards on him. Could he have a couple big games? Sure. But, I mean, I'll take the under.
Oliver?
I'm going to say by the seemingly sort of pent-up aggression that was let out in that CNN interview, I don't know if he's in the right, you know, mental place. I don't know. But either way, I know that he's going to be watching our cannabis hit on Monday, given his role in Potcoin.
That is the kind of analysis we are looking for. You guys have an awesome weekend.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome back. That was Kevin Kelly with Bloomberg and Oliver Rennick with TD Ameritrade. Joining us now is our good friend from MarketWatch, personal finance reporter Jacob Passy. Jacob, how are you?
Good. How are you all?
Doing great. You are coming in on the heels of Kevin and Oliver talking about all kinds of interesting things like taxes and cannabis and and the summit in Singapore. More importantly, if you would, please tell us a little bit about this AT&T and Time Warner merger and how that could affect people.
Yeah, so this week a federal judge ruled against the Department of Justice, which had tried to block the merger from happening, and basically that set the wheels in motion for the merger to be finalized, and I think as of today it was. So this deal was, you know, first floated a couple years ago, back in 2016, and basically, you know, this is, you know, not the first iteration of a deal like this. It's very similar to Comcast, which bought NBC Universal a while back. So, you know, we're seeing this trend of cable TV providers buying media companies. Comcast also this week put in a bid for the media properties of 21st Century Fox. So, you know, this is an ongoing trend, and folks who study this industry and consumer advocates are concerned about the effects that it could have, because basically what it could do is it could make it much more difficult to, you know, watch all the TV shows you want to watch, and much more expensive, because now that AT&T will have control over everything Time Warner owns, which includes CNN, HBO, CW, they will have more leverage when they are negotiating the rates with other cable providers to carry those channels. And so they can charge, you know, other companies like the Dish Network or Spectrum way more to carry those channels, and those costs obviously would be passed on to the consumer. And what some folks were warning is that we could get into kind of a situation like you see now with streaming devices, where if you have a Google Chromecast, you can't access Amazon Prime content. So, you know, that could be, you know, some that could be the future of what we see with cable TV, where you may need to, or with streaming, where you may need to, you know, have multiple subscriptions to get access to all of the shows and movies and everything that you want to watch. And another concern, go ahead.
I was going to say, I agree with you, Jacob. I mean, I think that that's certainly a concern. We've talked to Natalie Walters, who covers tech for The Motley Fool, about, you know, content is obviously king. And we all, you know, as we've talked about it on the show and you all do in other venues, people want to create their own, virtually their own channel where they can customize their content. And
exactly.
It seems that there are impediments everywhere you go. I mean, you know, it's about cutting the cord, you know, is what they call it. But there are impediments, and this seems to be yet another impediment to kind of doing that.
Yeah.
So,
sorry. Yeah,
didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. Cord cutting, no, you bring up a great point, because cord cutting could become a lot more difficult. You know, what I was saying with Amazon Prime and Google Chromecast, you know, AT&T already owns DirecTV and DirecTV Now, which is their online streaming content service. And they're one of the largest players in that market. And, you know, to the extent that they now control certain media properties, you know, they could AT&T has a vested interest in the cable TV business staying afloat. And, you know, streaming is a huge risk for that business. And so analysts were saying that it wouldn't be surprising to see AT&T, you know, block access to Time Warner content on different streaming platforms to kind of, you know, throw a wrench in the gears and make it harder for them to grow their subscriber bases. And to the extent that that's the case, you know, we could see a downturn in the growth of streaming services, which obviously have been growing more and more popular because people are getting sick of paying these, you know, huge cable bills to get the TV shows and everything that they want. So there's reason to be concerned. If you're an AT&T customer, though, you might see some benefits. They might have, you know, special content for you. You know, the larger company, you know, would be able to, you know, invest in new technologies and things like that. So those folks might benefit, but other folks may feel the pain in their wallets.
I think it's an absolutely fascinating time to be paying attention to all these merger talks and conversations, just because I think that what media is going to look like in a couple of years is going to be totally different, and how we get our shows and everything else. So that's awesome stuff. Thank you, man.
Yeah.
Well, I know that the United States has not really gotten to the point of soccer enjoyment that the rest of the world has, but the World Cup is, it may have gotten started, or it's going to get started. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on with that.
Yes, the World Cup, it did get started. I think the first matches were played on Thursday. So these are, the preliminary, group round plays. So, different groups of teams will compete against each other, and then the best teams out of those groups will advance to, later stages in the tournament. And it's one of the biggest sporting events for betting markets. Back in 2014, analysts estimated that British gamblers wagered more than £1 billion, which was, at the time equivalent to about $1.6 billion,
wow.
Which was the biggest betting event in the history of the UK. So people love to gamble on the World Cup, but I gathered some research from different publications and different researchers that point to ways to make a better bet, because there are certain pitfalls you can easily find yourself in if you are not careful with your betting. So, and the biggest one is kind of almost counterintuitive, but experts suggest that you never bet on your favorite team, because you won't have as much clarity in judging their ability to win a match as you would with a team that you are not a fan of. You're more inclined to view their chances optimistically, which can lead you into a bad bet. But then on top of that, there's also, it's a way of hedging. If your favorite team doesn't win and you bet on them, you kind of get a double whammy of, losing money and also seeing your favorite team lose, which is never a fun experience. So experts are saying,
For sure.
Yeah, exactly. So bet on a team that's not your favorite. Hope that they do well. If they don't do well and your favorite team does well, it's not necessarily a win-win, but at least it's not a complete loss. And there are other tips. Complicated bets, there's all these, online betting companies, they push these bets on like which player will score first and things like that. And those are incredibly difficult to, to predict. And the odds are very low, compared to, a 50-50 odds of a team winning potentially or something like that. So you don't want to, you want to keep it simple. And that extends to, beyond the World Cup. This past week, at the Belmont Stakes, if you bet on Justify to win, that was going to be a more likely occurrence than, getting like one of those exacta or superfecta bets that are just, the odds are much lower.
Yeah, that's behavioral finance 101, right, Jeff? I mean, you're probably way too close to your favorite team to make logical decisions about it.
Well, as a Washington Capitals fan who's suffered many a defeat, until now I had to wait, 40 years basically to see my team actually win the Stanley Cup. But I would say it probably makes a lot of sense. I will say, preface all this, but we're not advocating for anyone to go out and bet. It's just kind of more for information. But, I think, food for thought.
I think people should definitely, look at their emergency fund and make sure that's well stocked before they put any money in betting markets.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
Well, Jacob, excellent work again, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
And give our best to Allie. I think she is studying for her CFP exam, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
She is indeed. She's in a marathon review session right now. So those exams are coming up. So she's hitting the books.
I've been seeing her tweet about solving problems online. So. Please, I'll have to tweet back at her, but we wish her the best on her exam passage, exam prep, and we look forward to having you both back in the coming weeks as soon as, she's out of it, I guess.
Thanks,
yeah,
Jacob.
For sure. All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was a great segment, George, with Jacob Passy. We certainly wish Ali Melito all the best in her studies as she's studying for the CFP designation.
No small test right there. So
no,
sure
not a small test at all. No. But I want to welcome back to the show Josh Franzell. He is from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. And we've also got his research colleague, Mr. Gerald Young. Guys, welcome, Gerald, and welcome back, Josh, to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to hear about your research. And I know, Gerald, you worked really hard, you in the center, and Josh worked really hard keeping up with your workforce survey for public sector hiring trends. Can you share a little bit about your findings, about the research in general, and what you found this year?
Sure. So let me kick it off. This is Josh. So as a bit of background, we've been doing this annual survey in conjunction with the International Public Management Association for Human Resources and the National Association of State Personnel Executives. We've been doing it every year since 2009. And what this survey overall has enabled us to do is offer us a window in terms of looking at what workforce changes states and localities were making around the country, what benefit and benefit changes they were making, both for retirement benefits and for healthcare, and what are some of the key issues that were keeping human resource professionals up at night in terms of some of the ongoing concerns and ongoing areas of focus that they're focused on from their individual human resource professional perspective. This year, we released a report back in May, and it really walked through not only 2018 findings from the annual survey, but also reflected back on a decade's worth of really high-quality data. Gerald, you want to walk us through some of the key points?
Certainly. I think one of the real changes that we've seen is that in the immediate aftermath of the recession, most state and local governments were going through a retrenching, either cutting positions or freezing pay or freezing the hiring process itself. And most of those cutbacks have tapered off, replaced to a degree by hiring, but the hiring has not necessarily brought them back up to the levels that they were prior to the recession. They're, you know, coming closer, but not yet there. And in part, one of the challenges that they're facing is that with the unemployment rate being as low as it is right now, it is very difficult to hire for certain positions within state and local government. That's really across the spectrum of what they're looking at, but particularly positions like police, engineering, IT, you know, things that there is potentially a market for outside of local government, the skills, the backgrounds, the education experience, you know, maybe things that a private employer is looking for as well.
All very interesting. I know we've talked about on this show, and we've read about in the news, very difficult to attract police officers and firefighters in certain jurisdictions. And I have drawn the inference that, you know, the retirement benefit is one of the most important incentives, right? I think maybe that, I don't know if that's one of the reasons you can kind of tie back to, but that certainly, to me, from the outside, looks like that is a very big incentive to attracting those people to come work for state and local government. And, you know, if that's being reduced or removed or eliminated, you know, that can certainly be, I would think, to be an impediment. Is that similar to what you found in some of the key points in your research?
I think that is. Yes. Go ahead, Josh.
Oh, no. So I just want to say, I think you're spot on with what you're saying, Jeff. And actually, one of the questions in this year's survey and the past couple of surveys we've done is asked how competitive the HR professional thinks the wage compensation is relative to the labor market and benefit compensation is relative to the labor market. And more or less around half of the HR folks thought that their wage compensation was competitive. But where the differentiating portion was about 90% thought their benefits compensation was competitive, you know, in the market when competing for talent. So I think you're spot on in terms of the role that these benefits play in attracting and retaining folks.
And, right. But
as far as the status of those benefits, over the last several years, at least, going back to 2012 in our research, there were quite a number of agencies that had been cutting back on benefits in one way or another. It may have been that they were increasing the share that the employee needed to contribute, or they were changing the qualifications to receive those benefits. The percentage is not quite as high as it had been in the past, but still many of those changes have taken place and have impacted the desirability or the value of those benefit packages. And we've also seen now some research that's pointing to a diminished quality in the applicants that jurisdictions are able to attract to those state and local job openings.
Got it. In all this data, was there anything that was surprising to you guys? Or what was the most surprising thing?
One of the things this year that we added to the survey was, you know, we've known for a while the positions that continue to be hard, that states and localities continue to have a hard time filling. But what we added this year was the question about what they're doing in terms of using the gig economy and gig economy positions to fill some positions. And it was quite interesting in terms of states and localities using gig workers for, you know, as you would imagine, building and grounds cleaning, maintenance work, but others in terms of business and financial operations or IT or accounting. And it's still a small portion of the overall state and local employers that are doing this. But I would encourage, you know, your listeners to check out question 4 on our survey report, which is available on slge.org, because not only do we highlight the overall positions they're having a hard time recruiting for, but also what positions are being filled at least somewhat by gig workers.
And I think one of the other surprising things in the findings was that as much as technology is a prerequisite for so many positions in either the public or private sector these days, among the skills that employers are really seeking out, the top one is interpersonal, and close behind it is written communication, much more the traditional skills for an effective manager or employee than strictly the technical.
Wow. That's interesting. Very different than what I would have thought. Kind of a reversion back to the traditional skill sets that we all need. Very interesting. And I'm looking at your site now, Josh, that you referenced. It looks like you're doing you did a webinar on the 13th about some of these findings. Is that a recorded webinar? Because obviously in the 10-minute segments that we have, we don't have that much time to get into the meat and potatoes of what is obviously a very robust study. Can people listen to that webinar online, like a refresh of that webinar?
No, absolutely. If you go to the events section of our website, there's a YouTube of the whole webinar along with the slide deck that we used when we were presenting the information. So we encourage anyone to go, and it's freely available, and to have a listen and watch and use the recorder if they see fit.
Thanks. And I'll post those on social media when we post a show, so that people can check that out and link directly to your site. You guys are constantly, what I love about the center is that you work with other organizations. You reference your work on this particular survey. Last month we had you on with Jean-Pierre Aubry from Boston College's CRR. What's coming down the pike in terms of additional research that you guys are working on, that you, Gerald, and the rest of the team are working on, that we can check up with you on in the next couple months?
Well, I think a couple that you should be on the lookout for is we're working with the National Association of State Retirement Administrators right now on a study that looks at policies that are in place around the country for enabling or not of the reemployment of retirement eligible employees. And so we're looking at policies and how whether or not employees are allowed to come back and work in other positions in government and how that impacts their retirement benefit. It's the first of its kind study that we're really excited about. And not only is collecting information about data on the policies, but also we're going to be doing a series of case studies as well. One other thing I would want to mention as well is on a separate project, we're working on a project that looks at financial wellness programs that are administered by local governments for their employees. Now, you know, financial wellness and financial literacy certainly gets a lot of attention, you know, in the private sector and somewhat for federal workers in the military. But what we want to do is explore what local governments can do for their employees to help them not only save for the long term for retirement and other priorities, but also in the medium and short term, and how they help their employees save.
Well, guys, this is such important data. We appreciate you coming on. Hopefully, you'll be willing to come back. You had a positive experience. You'll be willing to come back on in subsequent months and share more of this insight. And again, we will post a link to the research so people can check it out. And you know, I really think, George, that and guys, I think that this is an often overlooked the impact of all of these things is really often overlooked by many people. You know, we oftentimes take for granted the work that our public employees are doing on our behalf. And you know, I'm really happy that we can kind of shed some light on these issues, and hopefully people can do a lot more research, learn about these challenges, and we can come up with some optimal solutions.
Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. That was Josh Franzell and Gerald Young from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. I can say that 10 times twice, George. That was a great interview. But we've got, you know, we're going to up our game. We do that on the Weekly Pulse every week. And we've got a great guest. She's the co-founder and president of the National Association of Retirement Plan Participants, Ms. Laurie Raleigh. Laurie, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. Try saying that name 10 times fast.
Well, you know, I think it's a lot easier. You know, I am the I have like mush mouth sometimes when it comes to speaking, but it's great to speak with you today. And we're so fortunate to have you on. Before we dive into it, I know you all just completed a survey, a really interesting survey.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little about your organization, where you're located, what the basis is, what your mission is. I think people would be really interested to learn about it.
Okay, great. So, well, first of all, I just want to say thanks. It's great to be here with you guys today. So we're located in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and NARP is a 501c3 nonprofit. And our mission is really to help everyone have a more secure financial future. And there's a lot of ways that we do that, and one of which is this study that you were just referencing, which is a study that we do every year. We've been doing it for about 5 years now. And it's really to uncover what are some of the barriers that are preventing people from making good financial decisions. And it's really a roadmap for improving retirement savings outcomes. And we do it with about 5,000 participants. And the study really lays bare what the friction points are that are preventing people from engaging with their retirement savings. So that's one of the big aspects of what we're doing in NARP.
So what's the answer?
What's the answer? I know.
Yes.
I was hoping you were going to ask me that. No, so there's really a couple of things that emerge through all of these studies that we do. And it's sort of these big topics, which are people are feeling financially stressed and a lot of pressure, financial pressure, with people, you know, kind of stuck in this moment in time where they're having to help other generations in their family with financial issues. So you see a lot of people having to help their parents financially or helping their adult children. And it's really putting a lot of pressure on a lot of the population that's looking to save for retirement and wants to save for retirement. The other aspect that's really impeding people's engagement and ability to save, aside from those financial stressors, is the fact that there's very little trust in financial institutions. And trust is what creates engagement. So without trust, it's going to be very hard to engage people in making financial decisions.
No question
about
that.
That's a topic that we really are interested in and have really been digging into.
Okay. And what's an action step from there?
What's an action step?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we've looked at is, like, why? Why is trust so low? So, you know, events in the last decade haven't helped. But putting those aside, you know, the industry hasn't done enough, the retirement savings industry, they haven't really put enough attention, in my opinion, into one thing that builds trust, which is communications, right? So communications are how we create trust. Trust is a primal feeling that we have as human beings. That's what's allowed us to survive as a species. And we can't engineer trust out of the customer experience. The other point is that we don't trust things that we don't understand. So if you look at this data from our study and other industry studies, everyone finds the same thing, which is that people don't understand retirement savings and investing, and they're not getting the help that they need to make financial decisions. And if we don't understand things, they're inherently risky to us, and risk prevents us from trusting and engaging. You know, I think that the accepted orthodoxy in the industry is that communications and education don't work. And so there's not a lot of time and effort put into it. And I think that that's true. I think that bad communications and bad education don't work. But when you do it correctly, and you remove the jargon and the complicated language, you know, we've been able to prove over and over again that you can increase all kinds of metrics and behavior when you change the communication method.
I love that we're talking about this, because we talk about this often on the show. It's about engagement. It's about finding a medium and a message that reaches all different types of people, because each retirement plan is its own ecosystem. And in that ecosystem are individuals who consume information in all different ways. And it's about tailoring messages and finding the right approach to reach and target people. And I think you're right on a lot of those fronts. We'd like to see much more in terms of communication, education, and reaching people, and you know, not just make it a marketing event. It's about, you know, that holistic, I hate using that word, by the way, but that holistic approach to that whole life cycle of looking at a retirement plan. It's not just about retirement. It's about living your life and all the financial events that occur throughout your life.
Right. So what you're hitting on is something really important that builds trust, which is relevant, right? So we don't just think about our retirement savings as one kind of siloed event. It's a touch point along with a multiple other financial touch points that we have to all measure and balance as we're living our lives. And I think that there's this real resistance in the industry in general to really kind of dig in and think about how can we create communication experiences that are landing with participants. I think that everybody kind of wants to just rely on auto features. And I think auto features are great, but they have to be accompanied by appropriate trust-building communications. And I just want to point out as a case in point to sort of make my point about building trust and how you can infuse trust and communication messages that engage people. If you look at business models that are emerging in other areas outside of the retirement savings space, look at companies, think of like Airbnb and Uber and Facebook and Lyft and Instagram. These companies have learned to create communication experiences that build loyalty and engagement. And in return, you have to give up your time, your data, your privacy, everything, and to engage with those companies. And they're wildly successful at doing that. And they're similar to the retirement savings industry in that if you think about it, like Facebook doesn't have a product, right? And in retirement savings, they're not really a tangible product either. But they're doing a great job at engaging people and having them give over information and do things all the time. We're not doing a great job in the retirement savings industry. And on top of that, we're asking people to save more money that they get money back in the future. And by the way, you'll probably get a match when you do it at blown away. So you'll earn a little extra income on top of it. So I think that there's a big case to be made too. We need to rethink communications and the messages and how we can design more human-centered communication experiences that improve outcomes.
I think that is hitting the nail on the head, and obviously easier said than done, but that is the fundamental thing that needs to happen. You need to figure out how to meet people where they are, because if they're 25 years old or if they're 55, you just need some mechanism for impacting their behaviors. So
Yeah, I just want to say one of the things that we've been doing at NARP is that we've been actually testing these communication messages. So we work with behavioral finance experts and experts in human-centered design, and by kind of merging those two fields together, we've been able to do, and we've done this multiple times with some big plan sponsors, we can increase plan participation by 25% over and over again in different plan settings, and increase savings rates by 50% by doing nothing else except changing how we're communicating with people. And I'm not talking about like build up some kind of digital app or something like that. I'm talking about literally the words and how we're presenting the information to people. And so we have those test cases. I'm happy to share them with any of your listeners if they'd like to see that. But I think that we absolutely have the data, and I'm sure the people do too, that proves that you can change the communication message and improve outcomes.
Yeah, I case studies matter, and I think it's very important to have a roadmap forward and see what other people do. I mean, it's never going to be the same from organization to organization in terms of, you know, if you're a government and you try this method, or you're a corporation, you try this method. But I think you can learn, and we talk about it on the show all the time, you can learn from so many other people and how they do it, what they're doing for their retirement plan, and just adjust tactics. I think the one thing that I've learned over the years of working in this business, and I think I don't want to speak for George, but I think it's the same, is that, you know, you've got to always be adapting. You cannot, you know, this is not a business. In order to reach people and engage people, you've got to be adapting. And we're in a content-heavy environment now where people are getting messages through their phones, through their devices, through their emails, through text, whatever, and they're getting blitzed with messages. And retirement, as we talked about earlier in the segment, is not just about age 65. It's all the points in between and all the events that occur from the time you're an early adult to the time you and through retirement. So, you know, it's exciting. And we'd love to, can we link to your site to, or how would you like us to do that?
Yeah, sure. We can link to our site. You can find some of the work that we've done on our NLAB site. So that's nlabdesign.com. And you can put a link on there, too, that we can show.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
Yeah,
my pleasure.
This is great. We'll have you back next month. We'll catch up with you and learn about more tactics that are happening with these retirement plans and successes.
That'd be great.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Welcome back. That was Lori Rowley with NARP, giving us a lot of great insights, and joining us now, two of our favorite guys, Mr. David Levine and Mr. Kevin Walsh with the Groom Law Group. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, good to be here on a summer Friday.
On a summer Friday, indeed. So fill us in. What is top of mind this week?
Top of mind this week? We're picking up on something we've talked a little bit about, I think, a couple weeks ago. About, we talk about data privacy, data issues, but we're going to go a little bit deeper on it today. We're talking about plan data and participant data. Who owns it? What can you do with it? And the answer is there's no perfect answer, but some plaintiff's lawyers are certainly trying to find out.
So, yeah, really, information as a plan asset is, it's kind of the shorthand for this, but the idea is that plans have lots of information on their participants. And frequently, when they interact with service providers, record keepers, or any other kind of player in the retirement space, one of the things that they have to provide to those service providers is information about who the participants are, how to contact them, or various pieces of information about their financial history or email addresses. And kind of a lurker of an issue has always been, well, when you give that data to a service provider, should that be considered comp to the service provider? Or when you give data to a service provider, do they then have to essentially treat that as a plan asset? Do you have an obligation as a fiduciary to protect that information? And it's really come into the forefront a lot more recently with some litigation. So, David, Devan versus Northwestern University.
Yes.
That's really the key one right now. What are your thoughts on what the court said there?
I think the simple answer on that one is that the court said the claim doesn't get to go forward. It's out. It's not part of it. The court doesn't buy into this theory. At the same time, it's a court, and the it's one court, and there are many courts, many different areas where you have the claims. Because
wait, so that doesn't end it? We can't just wipe our hands and say we're done?
I would love to say we're done with everything, but then you and I wouldn't have jobs.
I was just going to say.
So if that's the case, we should turn then to what's going down down in the land of Vanderbilt. What do you think of that lawsuit, since you want to put me on the spot?
Well, I wasn't trying to put you on the spot there. I think the Vanderbilt case is interesting because it essentially goes at the idea here, which is, I mean, whether something's a plan asset, it comes down to ordinary notions of property rights. And that's the phrase we use in ERISA, ordinary notions of property rights. And the court hasn't decided there, but there is an opportunity for a split because some of the arguments that are being made are that, you know, you could sell participant information, you can probably exclude others from accessing participant information. Those are types of things that you can do with other property. So they're trying to get the court there to say that, well, under ordinary notions of property rights, plan information is a plan asset. And I think we're really going to have to watch as it develops, particularly in light of how the Northwestern case, there's an appeal with the Third Circuit pending.
And I think to maybe round it out on this, the big takeaway is it highlights the role of plan information and who is offering and using what services. We've seen the question about service offerings and how a plan is working with a vendor is a big topic in a lot of the lawsuits that have been out there at this point. And it shows that it's not going away anytime soon. So if you're a service provider, making it clear what's doing, because there's no formal bar saying that you can't do it, but the plaintiffs don't agree with it. It's to be clear and try to cover yourself there. If you're a plan sponsor, understanding what's being done with your data. It's all about negotiation. At least our view of the world is having everybody understand what page they're on. And that's where we leave it for this week.
Well, and then kind of...
Oh, I was leaving it. You're not leaving it.
Well, I think kind of more big picture, it highlights the need for kind of service providers and plan fiduciaries to think about, well, what is and isn't a plan asset? So information is the thing we're talking about now, but can contracts themselves be plan assets? Are the assets underlying the contract plan assets? When you're thinking about ERISA's obligations, it just highlights the idea that it's not always limited to just the money of the plan. It can really touch a lot of other aspects.
Absolutely.
I think
on that note, we're done.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that, and I appreciate all your input. And David, one of your last points hit the nail on the head, at least for me. How much latitude or leeway does a plan sponsor have to talk to their provider, the record keeper, and say, hey, here's what I want to make sure doesn't happen with our data? Can they ask that to be written into the contract or the agreement?
The answer is it varies from provider to provider, to the size of the plan, to the arrangement. There's no one answer on this. And the uses of the data vary from provider to provider. So there's no black and white answer.
So,
and I think, and candidly, it's something that plan sponsors and service providers struggle with every day. So that, yes, it's the top of mind for all.
Okay. So they could certainly ask as to whether or not...
you can always ask a question.
They'll do anything about it.
Yeah. Much like a lot of contract negotiation, leverage plays a big role.
Yeah, I would add, having worked in the public sector especially, there are rules, and you guys do as well, there are rules that states and municipalities have related to the management of data, or even what they can send over to the vendor or to their vendors, to their partners. And for me, what you were articulating just is another issue related to data. And I was thinking data as it relates to data privacy. That seems to be an incredibly important issue that not only are we dealing with in retirement, but we're dealing all across the computing world. And then this is yet another issue that has to be, who owns that? Who owns that intellectual property, for lack of a better term? It's a lot of responsibility for plans, for fiduciaries, plan sponsors, people to think about in concert with their legal counsel, consultant, all the people that are around the table working on their plan.
Absolutely. That's even more macro thing. We'll just say the awful four-letter word, GDPR, and we'll move on.
Well, great work, gentlemen. I hope you guys have wonderful weekends, and as always, we appreciate your contribution.
Thanks for including
us. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Jeff, another successful week, sir.
Yeah, I mean, a great run of guests, everyone contributing on their own time, and for the betterment of everyone in terms of saving and planning and learning about retirement. I think we had a great round of guests. We covered so many issues this week, George. And so, you know, I hope you enjoy Red Wing, Minnesota.
Well, thank you.
And did I get the Minnesota part right? You like that?
Yeah, Jeff. And I'm going to enjoy some pop here this weekend, because that's what you drink in Minnesota is pop. For all you folks on the East Coast, that's what we refer to as soda.
Soda. And you're going to have a Father's Day, obviously. You're a dad, so you're going to be celebrating Father's Day. I know I'm looking forward to wishing my father and stepfather a happy Father's Day as well. And I hope that our guests, contributors, and our audience have a great time with their families. I mean, it's really a special time. Enjoy that time. We're going to look forward to having another great podcast next week.
Yes, indeed. All right, sir. Thank you.
All right. Have a great weekend. Yeah!